standard SBO model is a division of authority. I've got admin privileges, which is essentially the DBA. These are the guys that alter structure. Create, drop, alter tables, that kind of thing. And then users are the ones that are inserting, updating, deleting, and querying. They change the data, but they have no power over the structure. If you want to really mess yourself up, don't have a good distinction between them. Let the users be able to change the structure, see what happens. My little horror story from that was from a company called Amgen. It's a pharmaceutical company. They got rich overnight because one of their patents came through. 10 years, 15 years of research that suddenly makes you a millionaire. But they there were two sources for physicians' data that they were using, because they got people who were used to this trade. You set up sales routes based on the doctor's specialties. So I'm trying to remember, Phoenix data and Med data, one of them used an abbreviation code for the doctor's specialties and listed either 3 or 5 of them. The other one used a numeric code, it was strictly their own, the specialties, and listed 5 or 3. I don't know the exact thing. One guy had written systems using Med data, the other guy had written systems using Phoenix. They each had their favorite, and both sets of tapes were coming in from the respective suppliers. So they each independently sat down and wrote alter table scripts to replace the specialties columns with their favorite. And they would literally, before they ran their reports, play the script, load their tape, and send out their reports, and not tell anybody. The database was structurally never the same more than twice a day. And I was the outside guy brought in to look at it. People always call me in when we've got a database that's falling apart. They never call me in to say, hey, look, it's working fine. It's like being an undertaker. No, think about it. It's a medical specialty. What's the worst that an undertaker can say? It was terrible, dear. I gained one on the table today. But taking the DBA privileges from after they had it for a while, it was a big fight with the programmer.
They even go that far. I mean, I am just done with one database replication project, really creating replication software. And one of the questions that comes up every so often from people is, how do we do schema changes? They still write self-modifying code, because an application that as a daily routine does create and drop tables is self-modifying code.
Yeah.
But they don't get it. They don't understand this.
The other one is, depending on which product you got, how does your dynamic SQL go? And one of the things with the SQL Server Sybase family is the ability to create tip tables on the fly. That's not so bad. But I can also assemble dynamic SQL inside a procedure and execute it. So I have no idea what's going on. In fact, that's even worse in some ways, because they're expecting an outside user to fill in something. And something is what's called SQL injection. That's where I send in a string from a keyboard as a user, only in the middle of it, there's a semicolon, followed by a bunch of executable code, followed by another semicolon. And suddenly my procedure has created a dynamic block of SQL, only it's not doing what the original programmer thought it was. I've injected my own SQL directly into the database. Oh, like to do credit card fraud? Pissed with your employer and just want to start dropping tables? Okay. Really easy with dynamic SQL and no protections on it. It is a real problem. This is sort of elementary for you guys. Column names are unique within a table. Table names are unique within a schema. Another good one with dynamic SQL. They had one guy log on about 2 years back, SQL Server News Group, who's going to have to build a website with shopping carts. Okay, easy enough. I don't know if I can buy it off the shelf. But his thought was, how do I create a new table on the fly for each shopping cart? Yes. That kind of thing. Anytime you see somebody wanting to know how to create a table with a number on the end of it, a table name with a number on the end of it, oh yeah, that's a red flag, you know exactly what he's doing. There's a create table statement in a loop somewhere, cranking out essentially an instance of an object represented as a table. If all you know is OO, and you're used to creating objects on the fly, and you're not that sharp about garbage collection because your system's handled it for you, you could very quickly fill up a lot of storage space on what used to be a big hard disk to keep from your program ran.
That's not like creating new objects. That's like creating new header and you've got
Like we're going for the record-oriented people, they think table equals file. The OO people, they think table equals object or object instance. And you follow the other, with all you've got's a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You tend to do the, well, it's true with any technology. In the first movies, the camera stood in a fixed position, aimed at a stage, and the actors did their thing. The same way that you would watch it in a theater. W.D. Griffith was the first guy that thought, hey, we can zoom, we can pan, the camera can change position. We can tell a story with the motion of a camera. Wow, neat. The first skyscrapers look like Greek temples. Despite the fact that a Greek temple is horizontal and a skyscraper is vertical. You imitate in the new technology what you know from the old technology before the new technology gets its own voice. The classic one in this country is our railroad gauge. There were a lot of different gauges, but because we're basically a British colony that broke away, we used British railroad gauges. So that became the standard for us. But where did that come from? If you trace it back, it goes back to Roman chariots that were standardized, and the ruts in a Roman road for a two-horse chariot. So basically, we were following horses' asses. And the cute one with that is because of the railroad gauge. Fiacol is located in Utah, where I'm living. The principal industries in Utah are the Mormons. It's an industry. It owns over half the state outright. And various assorted companies that deal with explosives or nuclear waste. I'm not kidding. Well, waste disposal is a big thing in Utah. And in fact, we've got some of the highest cancer rates going because of all out from Nevada test. But when it came time to build the solid fuel boosters, Thiokol got the contract. They had to ship them by rail back to Florida, to Canaveral. And they had to be big enough to fit through mountain railroad tunnels, which of course were with the standard railroad gauge, blah, blah, blah. So the size of the space shuttle boosters had to be adjusted to the width of a Roman chariot. Otherwise, they wouldn't go through the tunnels. Things cascade. It's sort of interesting. Now, technically, in SQL, the name of a table can be the name of a column. This messes up your data dictionary something awful. And while it's legal, you shouldn't do it. Okay, my rule of thumb is scalar things like columns get a singular descriptive noun following ISO 11179 standards, which is basically a genus and species thing. Look it up. There's a couple of good websites for it. Good set of rules for naming things. And the tables are collective or plural nouns, so that you know they're a set when you see them. Now, standard column constraints are not null. This is another mistake we made. Not null probably should have been the default. Maybe we should have had to put in with null. So you have integer with nulls as a data type or something. Okay, we inherited that one. It's too late. We're doomed. If you're in the Sybase SQL Server family, you can declare a column to be explicitly null. But that's proprietary, so it messes up reporting. On the other hand, it does let somebody know what's going on. And since you had switches, you could set the system configuration type as to which the default was in the early products. It's almost necessary in a couple of cases. Default, underused. It's followed by a constant. There's no parens or anything around it. And I can also get to some system things like current user, current timestamp, and so on for my defaults. I don't know why people don't like to use them, but look around, you see that it is often used. Check constraints, yay! Finally, something with predicates in it can be passed on to the optimizer. Now, I can put my check constraint on a column. I can put it on the table, like hire date must be at least 18 years after birth date. Don't hire anybody under 18, involving two columns. I can also put it at the schema level with a thing called a create assertion statement for the existing standard SQL. The reason for the create assertion statement, besides being a nice place to collect everything, is that all check constraints are true on an empty table. And maybe one of your constraints was, this table can't be empty. So the create assertion is a way to go around that. Unique and primary keys. Again, primary key was sort of an old idea. Codd took a little time when he was first doing the relational model to realize that keys are keys. And the idea of anointing one of them to be prince of the keys was kind of silly. Didn't make any sense mathematically. But that was what was there. That's what got put in the language. A lot of products favor the primary key. And when we get to foreign key, primary key references, the primary key of a table becomes the default for the reference. But you see a lot of early products, especially where they have an underlying file structure, where the primary key has special significance. It's assumed that the primary key is the major way you're going to search this table. So let's do little things in the construction to favor the primary key searches. The reference clause, we've already mentioned. Unique came a little bit later. And the rules for unique and null are a little bit different. A unique constraint column or set of columns can have nulls in it. So you have a sort of not even in here. That can get a little messy. You can do some weird things. I can also have overlapping unique constraints. I can do quite a bit with them, actually, as far as putting things on it. Okay. Not null. Pretty much explains itself. You guys are used to writing it, so it's there. The thing, when I do have a nullable column, though, that often happens, is instead of meaning one and only one thing, that null is usually a cover-up for a bunch of miscellaneous things. For example, if I've got a yes-no question, I've got yes-no, and let's say make it nullable. But does that mean he didn't answer it, or that it wasn't applicable? It's just null, I don't know. You need to know why the value is missing and exactly how the null is being used in the data model. Now, there's a whole bunch of arguments about nulls. Chris State doesn't want to have them. Dr. Codd wanted to have two of them. His two nulls were basically, the attribute exists, but I don't have a value for it. And the other one was, the value is missing and always will be because the attribute is missing. Like the view. If you ask my hair color, it would come out as a null. In the sense that, yeah, I got the attribute. I'm a mammal. I'm allowed to have hair. Mother Nature's sense of humor. But I'm not allowed to have feathers as a mammal. So the attribute for feathers wouldn't exist, and talking about the color of my feather wouldn't make any sense. SQL took sort of a middle ground to Codd's first model. It's got one null. It's got a set of rules. At least, if we had an extensible language where everybody could write their own kind of missing value things, you'd have a real mess. At least with null, well, everybody disagrees about them, doesn't like them, at least they're consistent. Basically, they propagate. So you do have to watch out for them. You should have a good reason for making something nullable. You should have some control over it. You get default clause, underused.